We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Welcome to all the teachers and students who are joining us today. I'm Lisa Schmucke. I'm the founder of EdWeb, and it's my honor to introduce today's presentation from the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation. Today, we're presenting an interview with the Medal of Honor recipient, Sammy Davis, who received the Medal of Honor for his extraordinary bravery during the Vietnam War. Jason Robbins, who's a teacher at Steel Canyon High School in San Diego, California, is going to be conducting the interview. This fall, we are conducting a number of interviews with Medal of Honor recipients in conjunction with the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation, and I hope you will join the Medal of Honor Character Development Community on EdWeb. The link to the community is right there on this page and also posted in the chat, and you'll find incredible resources there. These interviews with recipients of the Medal of Honor are great original source material about their lives and experiences. And service throughout their lives. And this is a great resource as you work with your students and plan commemorations for Veterans Day on November 10th. So we hope you will join the community and access all the resources in addition to being here today.
Thank you, Lisa. We really want to welcome everyone out to this webinar today. We're grateful that you could join us. This is hosted again by the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation. And we want to thank the Jonathan Club, where we're at here in LA, for hosting us and providing us the facility to do this.
Certainly.
And especially the EdWeb team for making this technology available to us and allowing us to join you all over the country. I want to welcome all the students joining us. It's like we have about half high school students, about 15% elementary students. And again, as they said, my name is Jason Robbins. I work for the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation as a trainer. And then I teach full-time at Steel Canyon High School in San Diego. Right now I teach 12th grade government and economics. We're also joined off-camera by Noelle Wall. She is the Director of Education for the Medal of Honor Foundation. She'll be off-screen making sure the technology is doing its job and compiling all of your questions. And last but not least, we want to welcome Sammy Davis, who's joining us from Indiana. He's coming into LA to put together this webinar for us.
We're excited to be here with you.
Okay, a couple quick things. We have a bunch of questions from you that were already submitted by students and teachers as they registered for the webinar. We'll start with some of those, but we really encourage you to submit questions live in the chat box. Noelle will be compiling those. We want to encourage everyone to make sure you're paying attention for your question.
The more you respond, the more exciting it's going to be for everyone.
Absolutely. Very interactive.
Please interact.
Noelle, if Noelle sees several themes from questions, she'll combine some of those. And if she does that, make sure you're listening so you can hear the answer to your question, and we'll go from there. All right, you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay. First question we have for you. Can you start off by telling us what it was like to grow up in the Sammy Davis household as a kid and with your family?
Growing up in the Sammy Davis household. Well, I had six brothers and sisters, and I was right in the middle. Had older brothers and one younger brother, two younger sisters. We spent most of our time, we usually lived in the country. We spent most of our time playing in the woods simply because that's what we did back then. So the lessons that we learned, I learned from my big brothers. And common sense stuff, you know, don't eat bugs.
Has any of that kind of stuck with you? The things you learned as a kid, those hobbies stuck around?
Oh, most certainly. Most certainly. Things that my mother taught me about not leaving my little brother in the woods was one of the things that still has been in my heart the rest of my life. You don't leave your brother.
Very good lesson for all of us. You talk quite a bit in your vignettes and as you travel around about making your family proud, especially your grandpa and your dad. Where does that come from? What is that importance of making your family proud? How is that instilled in you?
That was just a fact. You know, Mom and Dad always said, well, you don't want to do this then because think how disappointed, you know, your family's going to be. Sometimes they would specifically mention the name of Grandpa or Grandma or, you know, depend on how it related. So it was always do the very best you can, always You don't lose till you quit trying, son. So don't quit trying. So I keep on.
Who's the person you, we got this question quite a bit. Who do you look up to as a mentor? We have a lot of people that would look up to you and certainly is what you've done to support this country. Who's the person you would say that you look up to the most? And why does that person stick out to you?
One of the people that have always been in my heart that to motivate me is Roger Donlin. Okay. Roger Donlin was, I seen him receive his medal on television in 1965, and just the visual image of him standing there so tall and so proud, and then I read his citation, and I can remember thinking, when I grew up, I'd like to be like Roger Donlin. Well, I'm 71 years old, and I'm still trying to be like Roger Donlin. But when I grow up, I'm going to be like Roger.
What was it like to meet him for the first time?
It absolutely blew my mind that I actually got to meet Roger, and he was even better, kinder, nicer than what I had dreamed that he would be.
Excellent. And for all the students joining us, Roger Donlin is the first recipient from Vietnam.
Yes.
There is a vignette on him, a wonderful story about courage and sacrifice. We encourage you all to go and watch that vignette. And thank you for sharing that about your hero.
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay, a couple other questions we got come in. If you could share any message to our students about the importance of family, what would that be?
Family is what the whole world is made of and about, in my opinion. So everything you do affects your family. So therefore, try to do the very best you can in all aspects of life. That's what my mother and father taught me, and that's what I've tried to teach my children. And we're all trying to live up to it.
We got a question from Christopher Moore asked, how have students that you've met as you've traveled impacted you over the years and through the presentations you've given? How have those students helped change you?
I have letters, I have text messages from students that I've spoke to all over the United States in our travels, talking to other schools or talking to military. I'll have young men and women come up to me and say, you talked to my class when I was in the sixth grade, and what you told us has stuck in my heart and motivated me to do what I am doing today. And I'm looking at them and they're, you know, in Airborne Rangers at Fort Benning, Georgia. And I go, wow, that's just awesome. How they have affected me is that, you know, you get tired, you hurt, you get old, but I've got to keep going because they motivate me. You know, just these young people in America, we have good kids in this country, and I want to keep doing whatever I can to help motivate them to stand up and do the very best that they can do, because we don't lose till you quit trying.
Thank you. Another question we got in, what was it like coming home from the war in Vietnam, and how did you transition from the war in Vietnam coming back into civilian life, if you will?
Well, I'm still transitioning. And other Vietnam veterans out there will understand that totally. Transitioning took a long process. How do you transition from being in a combat situation to being in a peaceful, loving atmosphere? Well, you do it very slowly, because what I realized is I react different. I reacted different to circumstances than most of the people that were in the room. You know, if somebody knocked a chair over, nobody else was excited but me. You know, of course, I would jump up and find out what's happening. And it's just been a slow transition to kind of calm myself down and not overreact to things and continue on.
We got a question from Jenny David asked, how did you end up in the career path you took after you came home? What are some of the things you've done since the military?
Well, yes, sir. I was medically retired from the military, went to work for a private company and worked there for a few years, and they medically retired me. My health just kept deteriorating, so I started accepting speaking engagements just to keep my mind and my body working and functioning. And that's what I still do today. I try to do as much speaking to schools, to the military, to private corporations. I go out and travel and speak, and it helps keep my mind rolling and my body working.
We got a question that, oh, sorry.
If you don't use it, you lose it. And that's what I found. So I keep trying to use it. It's working. My body's still working.
All right. And we really do want to thank the Davises for what they do. We're also joined today, who's in the room with us, is Dixie Davis, Sammy's wife, Mr. Davis's wife. We've been traveling this week, working with some teachers in Utah and around the country. We're grateful for what they do. And any of you involved in the CDP know how amazing it is to hear their stories and to hear what they have to say to the kids in this country. And we're grateful that even though sometimes it can be a big burden to travel, they certainly go and they keep going. And we're grateful for that. Grateful to have them.
You don't lose till you quit trying.
How can we help the soldiers returning home today? As these soldiers come back from different conflicts and serving, what can we do to support them?
I think the best way that we can serve those men and women that are coming home is to give them what they need, give them what we promised them, to take care of them health-wise, to take care of them financially as much as they have earned. We can't just put them off in the corner and forget about them. Because unfortunately, that's what happened to the Vietnam veterans. They were just shoved off in a corner, and we tried to go away, but that doesn't work either. So we need to recognize these young men and women and give them what they have earned, which is love and respect.
And kind of elaborating on with some of the topics with coming home and being wounded, is your health deteriorating because of your wounds in Vietnam?
My health definitely deteriorated because of what happened to me in Vietnam. Yes, the physical wounds, I've been able to have repaired almost all the physical wounds. The mental wounds require daily administration. You know, that's one of the things in talking to America. That's one of the things that helps the mental wounds in my heart. That's what keeps me rolling, is the positiveness that I receive from the young men and women that I speak to.
So you find that you get just as much back as you're giving to those students?
I get more back than what.
Awesome. Absolutely.
We have wonderful young men and women in this country.
I agree. As a teacher, you know, we often get told, you know, that's a difficult job. You're working with kids all day, but I find just as much enjoyment being able to go into a classroom filled with students and be able to give
most
to them, get as much back.
Most
somebody asked, what are some of your hobbies? What do you like to do in your spare time? I found out this week that the Davises travel over 200 days a year around the country and the globe, going and visiting and talking to students. So when you do have some downtime from all of your travels, what do you find interesting? What do you like to do? What do you like to go out and explore?
Well, I like to play with my grandchildren. I like to take them fishing.
You got to tell us how many you have.
We have 15 grandchildren. We have 4 children and 15 grandchildren. And it's just, they're a pleasure to be with and be around. And there's nothing any better than to take them fishing and sit on the creek bank on a 5-gallon bucket and sit there and talk to them while we're fishing, because you learn all kinds of things.
Absolutely. All right. Well, great. Thank you for sharing that. A couple questions about some of the actions in Vietnam on that day. First one is, how did you overcome the fear of being in that combat situation that was chaotic? How did you overcome that? What was something you did?
I don't think overcome is the proper word.
Okay.
What I found is, you know, I'm not an overly brave person, but I do love my brothers. And it's the love in your heart that will give you the strength mentally and physically to accomplish things that some think are impossible. But because I do love my brothers, I loved them then and I love them today. And that's one of the things that helps keep you going. Is that when everything else fails, you know, when your body's failing and you know you should be just totally scared out of your mind, but you love them. And that's what gave me the strength to swim across that river to get my brothers, was because I loved them.
Where does that come from? How does that develop? When you have a group of people who hardly know each other, aren't blood relatives, you get put in a difficult situation, how does that brotherhood form? What happens?
Well, you do for them what you would want them to do for you. That's where it starts. That's the cycle. And you don't lose till you quit trying. And that's why I kept going across the river and trying to do for my brothers what I knew they would do for me. So that's love.
We have one of our young students asked, what was it like to see 1,500 Viet Cong coming across the river and up to your position?
It was terribly disheartening, to say it mildly. There were just a small group of us artillery. Now, we did have some infantry that had been put in our position to help take care of us, to guard us. And that's where the men that I swim across the river for, that's who they were with. They were with the infantry. But we just took care of each other. And when we seen 1,500 enemy that was there, that's a lot of people, especially when you're in a jungle and you're thinking that, you know, you're the only ones there. And then all of a sudden, 1,500 people show up. It's mind-boggling. But you don't lose till you quit trying. And we just kept trying. We weren't going to give up.
Thanks. Thank you. Someone asked, what was it like to be told first that you're receiving the Medal of Honor? And then what was that day like when you went and were presented the Medal of Honor?
I woke up in the hospital in Camp Zama, Japan, and I'd been running 107 temperature. And I can remember the doctor coming in and telling me that I had been put in for the Medal of Honor. Well, I was grateful, but I didn't, in my heart, I knew that I'd had done nothing brave. And that's what, at that point, that's what I thought. Well, you could only receive the Medal of Honor if you're big, bad, and brave. And I knew I wasn't big, bad, and brave. I was just doing for my brothers what I knew do for me. I was doing my job. So it took a while for it to sink in that I really was going to receive the Medal of Honor. And when I went to Washington, D.C., to the White House to receive it, I can remember standing in front of the president, which most people have seen that scene of me receiving the
Medal of Honor. Yeah, this would be a good time to kind of elaborate on that. Which president?
Lyndon Baines Johnson. If you have watched the movie Forrest Gump, then you have seen me receive the Medal of Honor, because that is my actual film footage in the movie. When Forrest Gump is receiving the Medal of Honor, that is my actual film footage. They just put Tom's face over mine. And when I was standing there, my legs were shaking so bad, I thought I was going to fall down. And after the ceremony, my mother came up to me and she said, "Son, your legs were shaking so bad, I thought you was going to fall down." I said, "Mom, I thought I was too." I had been trained very well on how to do the job in the military that I ended up earning the Medal of Honor for. I had received absolutely no training, no input on how to go to Washington, D.C., and stand in the White House in front of the President of the United States and receive the medal. So that's why I was so frightened. You know, wow.
Lots of formality there.
Extreme formality, yes. And I was just no country boy.
No country boy. What did they, when they filmed the movie Forrest Gump, that, did they tell you they were going to do that? Or did you just?
The Pentagon actually told me. The Pentagon called and said that they're going to be making this movie, and they want any and all film footage that the Pentagon had concerning me. And I said, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" And they said, "Well, they're going to make a movie." "Well, what's the name of the movie?" "Well, we don't know the name of the movie yet." It took the Pentagon a month or two before they got back with me and said, "Well, the name of the movie is going to be Forrest Gump, based on the book Forrest Gump."
Awesome. Was that kind of cool that they wanted you?
Well, yes, sir.
You're like, why not?
It blew me away.
We have a question here. I think goes with a lot of different things. There's new series out. There's a one on PBS with Ken Burns and the Vietnam War. And you certainly see a lot more documentaries going. Since those have been coming out a lot more lately, do you get a lot more questions? Is it something that people are starting to talk to you more about, or less, or what do you see as far as
definitely the popularity of the Vietnam War on television has definitely added to the depth of the questions that students and people in general ask now, simply because they're knowing, you know, a 15-year-old young person doesn't know anything about Vietnam, so other than what they see on TV. So therefore, they ask questions of me, and I open up my heart and let them look in.
All right. Question, and you and I have already talked a little bit about this, but I think this would be an incredible opportunity for you to talk about. We've gotten several of these questions now. Have you been back to Vietnam since the war? And if you have, could you relate those experiences to us?
Dixie and I went back to Vietnam last year. Every year since I came home from Vietnam the first time, I always thought that, well, I need to go back to Vietnam. I would like to go back to Vietnam. And I kept putting it off. Well, I'll go next year. Well, I'll go next year. And last year, I turned 70 years old. And I realized that, well, if I don't go here pretty soon, I probably will not be able to go. So we better set it up. So we went back to Vietnam and got to go to every spot, every place that I had been stationed when I was in Vietnam, which was at least a half a dozen different places. Got to talk to people, got to talk to the children, and it was so rewarding mentally to be able to go back and see the people that I loved very much. The reason why I went to Vietnam was to help the people be free. That's why I went to Vietnam. And walking down the street last year, of Saigon, for instance, the amount of young people that would walk up to you and touch your arm and look you right in the eye and say, thank you. It warmed my heart then, and it warmed my heart now. One of the things that...
Was that surprising then?
Well, yes. In the back of my mind, I had hoped that's the way it would be, but I didn't know that was the way it would be. So when we got there, it turned out to be fantastic. The love that the Vietnamese people showed me as a Vietnam veteran was just phenomenal, and made me feel so much better. I had the privilege of being able to have a whole day with five of my former enemy that was there the night that I earned this medal.
So you got to meet five of the soldiers from the Vietnamese army that were on the other side of the battlefield.
That were my enemy, yes.
What was that like?
Well, the first hour was very tenacious, because they spoke about as much English as I spoke Vietnamese, which is just a very small amount. And so we had to speak through an interpreter. Well, I could see in their eyes the hatred, and that's what I'm describing it as. And when the interpreter would say, reinterpret what they had just been told, I knew that he was cleaning it up quite a bit, because it was not as mean and nasty as what his eyes were saying that it was. So I understood that. Well, after about an hour, things started settling out and calming down, and things started getting better. What I wanted to do was to let those five soldiers know that I did not hate them as Vietnamese. That's not the reason why I was there. The reason why I did what I did that night that I earned this medal was I was doing my job. I was doing my job as a soldier. It's not because I disliked that person. It was just I was doing my job as a soldier. And all of a sudden I could see the softness start coming back in their eyes when they were talking to the interpreter, and what they were saying had a more even flow to it. And then they got up when I told them that, then all of a sudden they got more excited and they said, that's exactly how we feel. We didn't hate you. We were just there doing our job as a soldier. We had about 9 hours together on that day. Okay. And it started off being very tenacious. We came together as former enemies. And when we left that evening, I firmly believe that we left as brothers. So that has helped my heart and soul tremendously to go back to Vietnam and meet with some of my former enemy, and it cooled my soul down tremendously.
That's an incredible story.
It was incredible. I'm hoping that I have the opportunity to go back again.
That was going to be my next question.
Yes, I would definitely suggest to all Vietnam veterans that if you can go back to Vietnam and visit the places that you served at, it's very rewarding.
Awesome. Thank you. I had a question, though. Outside of combat, what was your day-to-day life like in Vietnam? What were some of the things you did to either prepare or downtime?
Well, being in the artillery, when you weren't firing the piece, you were cleaning your gun.
Can you tell our students what artillery is?
Artillery is the large explosive rounds that you fire to help deter the enemy. The enemy would attack our infantry, and then they would get on our infantry, get on the radio and say, hey, we've got a bunch of the bad guys that are attacking us from this particular quadrant, and we need some artillery fire to push them back farther away from us so they can't get at us. So that's what we would do. We would put the artillery fire there. Well, if the infantry were not getting into firefights, well, then we didn't have much to do, so we had to clean our weapons and just do whatever we could to keep our minds and bodies busy.
Okay.
Which usually was not a problem. We had many things to do.
We're good at that. We entertain ourselves. Well, someone asked, what was your first meal back in the hospital, and was it similar to the portrayal in Forrest Gump, which I think, didn't he have a bunch of ice cream? All right. What was that like?
Ice cream.
Lots of ice cream?
I still love ice cream. I don't eat it very often anymore, but I still love ice cream. But that was one of the things that I can remember, because my fever had been running so high, and I can remember them bringing me little bowls of ice cream. And I would sit there and how good it tasted and how the cool made me feel better. Yeah. It was definitely ice cream.
All right. How many of the 12 survivors from your unit are still alive today?
Of our little group of men, there's about 7 of us that can usually routinely get together when we have our family reunions. I was not able to. We just had one in Washington, D.C. area, and I was not able to make it this year, but hopefully I'll be able to make it next year.
So you stay in constant touch?
Oh, certainly. Because I move around all over the United States all the time, I can usually call them up and say, hey, I'm here in Lafayette, Louisiana. Let's meet and have a glass of water together or something. So I get to see most of the guys off and on, and some of the guys only get to see each other when they can make it to the reunion. So it's always great.
All right. We have a question from Thomas Puzo in New Hampshire. He teaches a class on attitude, discipline, and respect. How do those values tie into your mindset as a recipient? Again, attitude, discipline, and respect.
Attitude, discipline, and respect. That is the key of life. Not only as a Medal of Honor recipient, but that is the key to life. And if you adhere to all those good things that you have learned, the attitude, your discipline, and respect for the people that you love and is around you, then you will do well in life. You know, no matter what you're faced with in life, you don't lose till you quit trying. So just keep repairing, keep rolling on, keep doing your job, and life will get better.
What was your reception like as soon as you came home from Vietnam?
As soon as I came home from Vietnam, well, they flew us home, and we landed in a military aircraft at Travis Air Force Base and in California. And they said that they would have to put us through rescreening to make sure that we weren't sick or nothing. They had to give us shots. It took 72 hours. That's 3 days constantly of standing in lines. That's, no sleep time, no whatever. You nap right there in the line waiting to get to the next station. Lots of shots, a lot of signing papers. And I can remember they broke us down in groups of 100. And the sergeant that was in charge of our group at one point asked us, well, how many of you have civilian clothing? Well, we all looked at each other. We'll just come back from Vietnam. None of us had civilian clothing. I mean, we may have had a T-shirt or something.
Yeah, your uniforms only?
Yes, sir. That's all we had was uniforms. That's all we had. Now, I'm sure there were some people that served in Vietnam that did have civilian clothing, but we were always out in the bush, so we didn't have civilian clothing. We didn't need civilian clothing.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, I can't let you go to the airport in military uniform. And we said, well, why not? You know, we just were issued brand new uniforms before we left Vietnam so we could come home looking nice. And the sergeant explained to us that the reason why was that they were going to take us to San Francisco to fly home commercial. And he said, there will be people there that will be doing unimaginable things to you as Vietnam veterans. And we just have decided that if you're in civilian clothing, they won't recognize you quite as readily, and you can hopefully slip by a little bit. Well, none of us had civilian clothing, so we went to, he said, get in the bus, we'll take you to the commissary, and you can buy civilian clothing. So we did. All 100 of us jumped in the bus, two buses actually, and they took us to the commissary. And the unique thing was about all, because of all the kids that were, had been coming home, they didn't have a lot of civilian clothing. They had all 100 of us bought white V-neck t-shirts with a pocket, and we had 501 Levi jeans and red top or tennis shoes, high top tennis shoes. And I remember the tennis shoes cost $1.25. And so we put all of our clothes on right there, and then fell back out in line outside. And here all 100 of us look exactly the same still, because we've got the white, everybody's dressed exactly the same. There was a couple kids that had colored shirts on, colored t-shirts, but we had civilian clothing on. So the sergeant had done his job. So we all got back on the bus, and on the way to the airport, well, he rode on our bus. And he explained to us what had been happening at the San Francisco airport. He said people were doing unimaginable things. He felt mostly just to get attention, because they knew if they, you know, hit a Vietnam veteran over the head, well, he'd be on TV or whatever. He said, don't fall into that trap. So there were three of us that were flying into Indianapolis, Indiana. And we bought our ticket at the Eastern Airlines counter and went around out the lobby and down the concourse where our plane was to be leaving from. And when we came around that corner, there was a group of about 30 hippies there, and they were very demanding. They wanted us to run the gauntlet, and we all knew what a gauntlet was. Well, remembering what our sergeant had just told us, we, you know, okay, we won't cause a problem. We'll just, you know, we won't run their gauntlet, we'll walk their gauntlet. So we picked up our duffel bags and fell in and started calling cadence, you know, left, right, keep order while we're going down to 30 people that had formed lines. And they started rubbing, well, they put on rubber gloves, and they had little paper sacks under the rope belts. And they took that out and started reaching into their paper sacks. And what was in the sack was what they'd picked up in their yard from their dog, or worse. And they started off by rubbing it in their hair and putting it on our t-shirt. And when that didn't get the response that they wanted, then they started trying to get it in their mouth and putting it in their ears. And we continued on. Yeah, we're thinking this is exactly what the sergeant told us was going to happen. So we just braved it through. Well, there were at least half of them had canes, objects of art is what later they called them. They were big clubs is what they were. And when we didn't react the way they thought we should be reacting, they started hitting us with their clubs, trying to get us to react negatively. Well, we just kept going. I heard the kid from Wabash, Indiana behind me, he went, ah! And I kind of looked over my shoulder. Now, we all had white shirts on, and I could see the blood just splattered all over his shirt. And I said, you okay, Wabash? He said, yeah, I'm okay. So we just kept going. When we completed their line of men and women, and we put our duffel bags down, we stopped and looked at each other. And we were all three covered with blood, you know, just nothing extremely bad, but we had all had where they'd been hitting us with clubs. And that kind of tripped our trigger, And we were getting ready in our hearts. We were going to go take out the 30 hippies, you know, three soldiers. We could take out 30 hippies, no worries. And when we were getting ready to make the charge, we could see right where we had started the gauntlet was a TV camera. And we could see the little red light beeping on it. So we knew that they had just taped everything, and they were taping what we were getting ready to do. And remembering what the sergeant had told us, that everything was going to be shown live at 5. So we stopped and we saluted the camera, and we picked up our duffel bags and went to the little podium where the stewardess was waiting to put us on the aircraft. It was probably about an hour and a half before our plane was to leave yet, but she went ahead and took us outside. That's when you had to walk outside and get on the aircraft. And she took us in and set us in first class, and we did not have first class tickets, but she set us in first class and helped us take our shirts off that were all covered with blood and wiped us and cleaned us all up and put Band-Aids on us and brought us a glass of champagne. And as a 20-year-old young man, I had had wine before, but I'd never had champagne. So here we are, we're sitting there in first class sipping champagne and toasting one another. When we landed in Indianapolis, we naturally called our moms and dad, told us when to tell them when our plane was coming in. And so mom and dad were, and all our families were there and welcoming us home. And they had signs that said, "Welcome home, son. We love you. We're proud of you." Gave us hugs. So the reception that we received in San Francisco was not kind, loving, or gentle, but the one that we received in Indianapolis was. So that's what we have tried to do for all of our returning veterans. That's the
welcome them home.
That's right. Try to meet them at the airports when we can. Give them what we knew that we needed when we came home, which is love and understanding and lots of hugs.
Excellent. What could our students do on that regard as far as when they see soldiers or that walking through the airports?
Simple thank you goes so far to help their hearts be better. Just a simple thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
Cool. Yes, sir.
So kind of on a personal question, the other day when I was in class, we had just shown a Medal of Honor vignette on one of the recipients, and it started a discussion, and a student raised his hand and said, "Mr. Robbins, do you think our generation is as intelligent or less intelligent than your generation or previous generations?" And instead of answering it, I kind of put it back on the class and said, "Oh, let's talk about it." And after about 15 minutes of discussion, we arrived that it was neither, but that it was maybe they're a little bit more distracted with everything that's out in the world today. And I'm interested on your thoughts on that. And I think my students are piping in with my substitute teacher. But could you give us your thoughts on whether you feel like they're more distracted, less, or have more opportunities out there?
I don't know if distracted is the proper word or not. I do believe that the young men and women of today is much more knowledgeable than I was when you know. I do a lot of talking to grammar school children, and it just amazes me of the questions that these fourth, fifth, sixth graders can ask. And when I ask them, "Well, how do you know that?" They say, "Well, it's right here on my cell phone." Yeah. The intel, the input that they receive through the media is just phenomenal, which we did not have. You know, as a fifth grader when I was a kid, you didn't know anything. I knew where to fish and
how to fish. So they have a lot better access.
Oh, certainly. They definitely have much better access today to that.
What warning would you give them?
Be careful on the proper usage of all that knowledge, because sometimes the knowledge that we learn is one-sided, one's just slanted one particular way. So you have to learn the whole truth, not just a portion of the truth. And that can be very difficult.
Okay.
But it's very important.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yes, sir.
We have a question from Anthony in Virginia. He wants to know what it was like to be shot with a beehive round. And if you'll explain what a beehive round is as you answer that.
What was it like? It hurt! It surprised me. You know, everybody, every soldier, especially, always kind of in the back of their mind, is thinking, well, how are you going to react if you get shot? How bad is it going to hurt? So when I got hit with the beehive, I thought I had been burned. That was the sensation. Beehives are little darts. They're an inch and an eighth long. They look like little arrows made out of spring steel. Got four little fins on them. And when I first woke up, because it had knocked me unconscious, and when I first woke up, that was the first thing that I can remember. I thought that I was on fire because my body was burning. You know, and I thought, wow. My head was still foggy is the only way that I can think to explain it to you. It was like trying to look through fog. That's the way my mind was. Well, why am I burning? And I would, I had a little bit of blood, but I wasn't even bleeding that bad. And I look at it. Well, as my mind cleared up and I took my flak jacket off because it was burning me. And I could see these beehives sticking through the flak jacket, and I'd pulled them out of my body because it was stuck in the flak jacket. And then things started coming, making more sense. And it hurt. it definitely hurt, but it didn't hurt as bad as what I thought it would. Yeah. I don't know if that's the proper explanation. I had been expecting this just totally mind-blowing, numbing pain, and it just burned real bad. Now, when I got shot in the right leg with an AK-47, that rolled me across the ground, and I can remember that very well. And that hurt, but it didn't hurt so bad that it made me quit trying.
Kept going.
I just kept going. You don't lose till you quit trying.
Keep doing your job. One of the hardest things to see as a teacher is when you have a phenomenal student that you know just wants to do everything the best they can. And they begin to struggle. You see them struggling with friendships, with relationships, with bullying, or even confidence. What advice could you give students about the importance of good friendships and looking out for one another?
You treat and do for others the way you would want them to treat and do for you. It's a simple thing, but too many of us don't do it for whatever reason. So you do for them what you would want them to do for you. That's how you get to be friends. That's the reason I swam across that river the night that I earned the Medal of Honor. I was just doing for them what I knew in my heart they'd do for me. That's what, no matter how young you are, if you do for others the way you would want to be treated, that's what makes it work. And it does work.
Another question just came in. What's one thing that you hope to accomplish during the rest of your life? What's something you want to do before, with all the time you have given?
One of the things that I work towards constantly is to put We the People back into our nation. Mm-hmm. I think that fact is so important that We the People are the ones that run this nation. Now, We the People vote other people in to make the rules and stuff, but still it is We the People that put those people there. And if we don't do our job as We the People, how can we expect them to properly represent us? So that's one of the things that Dixie and I constantly are doing, is to try to encourage America to stand up and be involved for whatever you believe is true and right in your heart. And if We the People do that, then this nation will continue to be the nation that we all hope it to be.
We have a bunch of teachers joining us today, myself included. What can a teacher do in their classroom to really help instill that in their students, both elementary, middle school, and high school?
What can they do?
What can a teacher
do? Well, teach them history, because from history is where we learn where we have been, and then encourage them to stand up for what they believe is right in their heart, because that's where we will be. Do you understand that? That's almost oversimplification, but it's very, in my opinion, it's very true.
It's a powerful lesson.
Yes, sir.
Someone asked, what advice do you have for someone who's thinking about or going into the military?
The advice that I have is to be very serious about it and then make it happen. The military has led me down paths in life that I would never even have dreamed possible as a very young person, but it has been very good. The military will be what you make of it. If you think, oh, this is the worst thing that's ever happened, it'll be the worst thing that's ever happened. But if you think, wow, this is awesome, and the opportunities that I get, the things I get to do, the people I get to meet all over the world, and it will be the very best thing that ever happened to you. So the military can make you be the very best person that you are capable of being.
All right. Thank you. Tell us about Mean Sergeant Gantz. Tell us who he is, what he did to you, and how those lessons may have affected you positively or negatively. For those of you maybe who haven't had the chance to watch Sammy Davis's vignette, he talks about Mean Sergeant Gantz, and there's some great lessons there, and I'd like Sammy to share a little bit about that.
My mean old Sergeant Gantz. Well, in Vietnam, he was one of my gun sergeants, and wow, he would make us do things that we could think absolutely no way could that how this applied to what everyday life should be. For instance, he would make us take every bullet out of our clips.
Every single bullet?
Every single bullet out and polish it with Brasso, which Brasso makes them shine unbelievably. And we couldn't think of any reason at all of why this mean old sergeant would make us do this other than he was just being a mean old sergeant. You know, when we weren't firing the howitzer, this is what we had to set. Usually we had at least 10 clips. Some of us had more clips than that. But you had to take the clip apart. You had to clean every bullet. And he said, when I look at that clip, when I look at those bullets, if the sun shining off of it doesn't hurt my life, it's my eyes, it's not clean enough. Well, we learned through experience the M16. This is when the M16 had first been issued.
That's the rifle that all the soldiers
had. That's okay. The weapon that all the small arms weapon that all the soldiers had. The chamber on them were so very tight that if you put a bullet into the chamber that had a grain of sand on it, for instance, that it would jam it. Well, within a few months, they actually corrected that problem and enlarged the chamber just a little bit and resolved the problem. But we were having great difficulties. We were in the mud and water all the time. And when you would pick your weapon up and try to fire it, and this is, you don't just fire the weapon for enjoyment, you were firing it because people were seriously trying to take your life. So it was important that the gun worked. And when it don't work, well, you can't just go up, wait a minute, I'm gonna quit here. You know, you no timeouts. What do you do? Well, Sergeant Gantz knew that if a bullet that's the whole cartridge, if it was so clean and so shiny that you could drop it in a mud puddle, and when you picked it back up, there was absolutely nothing on it because it was so slick and shiny that there would be nothing in the bore to get it dirty.
But he didn't tell you that.
But he didn't explain that to us. He just said, you got to do this, being the mean old sergeant. Well, after and it took a few weeks for us to realize that all of a sudden, us young men in Sergeant Gantz's section, our guns weren't jamming. And what the reason was because our bullets were so shiny that nothing stuck to them. Well, the other guys then started polishing our bullets. And
it spread like wildfire there.
Well, it worked. Yeah. That was the kind of things that Sergeant Gantz taught us. Now, when I became the sergeant, the mistake that I believe that Sergeant Gantz made was that he didn't explain to us why we had to clean the bullets. If he would have told us that, I think it would have made a difference. But when I became sergeant, I would tell my clean the bullets and they won't jam your weapon. That's an over-exaggeration, but.
Well, it's obvious that you have a strong brotherhood with everyone that you served with. And I know you have some very personal stories about your interactions with those that came home and those that didn't come home from Vietnam. Could you share with us one of those stories, which in particular about Shenandoah and your harmonica? We have about 10 minutes left, and we want you to have time to be able to talk to the students about that.
Well, of all the things that I learned while I was in Vietnam, one of the things that I learned was how to play a harmonica. And the reason why I got to learn to play the harmonica, according to my mother, there was a 63-day time period when I failed to write home. And the reason why I wasn't writing home on a regular basis is, what do you write home to your mama about? When you are in a combat situation, you can't just tell her, well, this is what happened today. I was very uncomfortable doing that. So I can remember thinking, well, surely something will happen tomorrow that I can write home to mom about. I thought it had only been a few weeks, but according to mom, it had been 63 days. 63 days.
You're in the doghouse.
So she went to the Red Cross in Martinsville, Indiana, and turned my name in. She said, you know, my son Samuel Lee Davis is in Vietnam, and I have not heard from him in 63 days, and I'm becoming very worried. Red Cross said, well, we will turn his name into the Pentagon. The Pentagon will run his name against the list of the wounded in action, killed in action, and we will let you know what their response is. Well, when the Pentagon was compiling the names of all the bad boys who had not been writing home to their mamas.
They had a list.
They had a big list. And realized that there were like 51 of us from our small unit that had not been writing home to our mamas, to the point that 51 mamas had contacted the Red Cross and had ended up in the Pentagon. So they said, well, we'll just write a letter to the captain. So our captain in Vietnam. So this was all unbeknownst to us. I can remember I was sitting out on the perimeter, the perimeter guard. Sun was just starting to come up. Sky was just getting pink, still kind of darkish down on the ground. And I heard someone walking in the rice paddy in the mud. And that got me all excited. And I looked, and it was within our perimeter. And it looked like a GI silhouette. And as it got closer, I could see that it was indeed a GI. And that it, as it got closer, I could see that it was my captain. Well, my captain had never come to talk to me on sitting on the perimeter at 5:30 in the morning before. So things were going through my mind. Well, why would my captain be coming out here at 5:30 in the morning to talk to me? Well, I thought, well, mom and dad's house is burned, or they've been in a bad car wreck. That was what was going through my mind. And the look on his face was very serious. So as he came up and stepped off in my foxhole and sat down, he said, well, you haven't been writing to your mother. And I said, well, no, sir. And he said, well, why not? I tried to explain it to him. And he said, well, I don't care what you write on. I told him we were always wet, so I didn't have nothing to write on. He said, I don't care what you write on. I don't care what you write about. But you will write home to your mother every day. So I started writing home every day, and I wrote about the mud. I wrote about the banana leaves. I wrote about the bugs, had all kinds of cool bugs, all, you know, but every day. Now, you can't get a whole lot of writing on a C-ration side box.
For the sweet.
And I would draw pictures of the bugs. Well, after a few weeks of doing this, I got a package from my mother. And it looked to me like it would be a package of mom's oatmeal raisin cookies that she was famous for. So I was all excited. It was just a brown paper wrapper in a box. And I opened the brown paper wrapper, and I could see the harmonica box. And on the box, it said, son, I hope this helps you be not quite so bored. So my writing home about the bugs and everything had worked. Mom was no longer concerned. In fact, she thought I was bored. Well, I didn't know how to play it. I just stuck it in my pocket, went back to my foxhole. Wasn't there 15 or 20 minutes, and one of my sergeants, Johnson Dunlap, came walking by, and he said, Private Davis, your mother sent you harmonica? And I pulled it out and said, yes, sir. He said, well, play Shenandoah for me. Well, Sergeant Davis, I don't know how to play Shenandoah. And he said, everybody knows Shenandoah. It goes like this. Well, he kept going and encouraged me to play. So when the E6 asks a private to play the harmonica, you start practicing. Well, within a couple of weeks, you could tell what I was trying to play. Sergeant Dunlap explained to me that the reason why he loved Shenandoah so much was that's where he was going to college out in Washington, D.C., and he would, when the protesters would get too bad, he would go up into the Shenandoah Valley, and he said it was so peaceful and so loving there that that's why the song Shenandoah is so important to him. Well, my sergeant was killed in Vietnam, When we dedicated the wall in Washington, D.C., I went and found his name, brought the original harmonica, and played Shenandoah for him, hoping that it would renew his spirit. I want to play Shenandoah for y'all here today. I hope that it finds a place in your heart, and when you need it the most, it will give your heart strength.
We have about time for just some final thoughts.
Yes, sir.
If you could share with our students one parting thought.
Parting thought. No matter what you're faced with in life, you don't lose until you quit trying.
We really want to thank everyone for joining us today. We hope that you were able to gain some great knowledge from Medal of Honor recipient Sammy Davis. Just a couple of quick announcements. And again, thank you to our web team for putting that together. All of this will be on recorded on edweb.net, and it will be available on the website, themedalofhonor.com. We archive all of them. And then you can also, the page you see there is the Medal of Honor Foundation website. It's a wonderful resource. We encourage you all to go to that. You can request the free character development program and thumb drive. There is a lesson on Sammy Davis in that kit on Hero versus Idols. And it's a wonderful lesson. I encourage you to go look that up today if you have time. And you can access all that, learn more about the Medal of Honor, the recipients, sign up for any of the live trainings, and read about any news or events, including future webinars, again, at themedalofhonor.com. And there's the community you can see there. That's the community where they're going to be putting all these on there, and I've already have some of them on there. You'll get all of the community resources are free, the recording, slides, quizzes, online discussions, and free resources. And we do have two upcoming webinars that are already booked, Robert Simonic, and that's Thursday, October 26th, and then Gary Luttrell, November 8th. We'll be doing those. Great opportunity for your students to interact again, and we really want to thank everyone for sending in questions. I know we weren't able to get all the questions. That's a good problem to have. Everyone was able to participate, and hopefully you're able to get a bunch of information and hear some of your questions answered. All right, thank you, and have a great day, and enjoy.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.